This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll speak with Abdin Jabara and Dorothy Zellner about the historic Gaza Freedom March.
Jewish activists and a Lebanese activist working very hard sent a delegation of 80 people from New York State to join 1,300 others to try to get from Egypt into Gaza.
We'll speak with a Chilean socialist who is facing U.S. deportation after 25 years in this country.
Victor Toro, twice a victim of 9/11, the first 9/11, which listeners will remember happened when the United States government helped overthrow a democratically elected socialist government in Chile on 9/11 of 1973. He fled dictator Pinochet's torturers, got to the United States, and now, because of the increased, quote, terrorism laws, they're trying to deport him as a terrorist.
Stay with us. We'd like listeners to know about this update. On December 17th, President Obama announced that he was going to nominate Sharon Brown to the board of the Legal Services Corporation. Now, what most people may not know is that Brown is a principal attorney and member of the senior management of the Conservative Pacific Legal Foundation. She's also a member of the Civil Rights Practice Group of the Federalist Society. We've talked about the Federalist Society being a conservative group of lawyers and law students around the country. What listeners may not know is that the organization she works for not only opposes much of what Legal Service Society stands for, but is also directly opposed funding legal service agencies. The National Lawyers Guild came out with a statement calling on Obama to withdraw this nomination. We believe that at the very least, the president is obligated to nominate someone who believes in the importance of ensuring that the poor be afforded the legal services they need. In a positive move, last week, Obama took measures to help the process of declassifying government documents become a little easier. He issued an executive order and a presidential memo to agency heads saying that the government should try harder to make information public when at all possible. That will include requiring agencies to regularly review the information that they classify and to get rid of any obsolete secrecy requirements. Obama also established a new National Declassification Center at the National Archives to expedite the process for declassifying historical documents. He also got rid of a rule that former President George Bush put in place in 2003. That permitted the leader of the intelligence community to veto decisions by an interagency panel to declassify information. Now, agencies who object to such a decision have to appeal directly to the president. These are small moves, but we hope we're heading in the right direction.
The end of December marks the one-year anniversary of the Israeli massacre of some 1,440 people, including hundreds of children, in Gaza. This year, an international delegation of over 1,400 people was organized worldwide to give publicity to the plight of the Gazan people living still under siege in an attempt to break the siege. Our own Michael Ratner and his family went on the trip. We've just heard the Egyptian government has refused to allow the freedom marchers to cross into Gaza from Egypt, although in a concession, 100 people were allowed to go over. We'll speak today with two veteran organizers of Palestinian Solidarity, Abdin Jabara, the former president of the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee, and Dorothy Zellner, an activist in New York City's Jews Say No. Abdin Jabara, Dorothy Zellner, thank you very much for coming down and welcome to Law and Disorder.
Very welcome.
The historic Gaza Freedom March is stalled in Cairo. It's just been an extraordinary thing. Abdin, Dorothy, give us a little background about how this march came together and what your assessment of it is now.
This has been one of the truly great historic international mobilizations of people in solidarity with an oppressed people in history. Thousands upon thousands of people over the course of a number of months have been working in over 42 countries around the globe to help make this happen. They used their own resources. They used their own time to gather in these various countries and travel to Cairo, Egypt, as a transit point to go to Gaza and march with tens of thousands of Palestinians to the Eretz border to protest the continuing strangulation siege of Gaza, a siege that has gone on since 2007. We are tremendously appreciative of the efforts of everybody that has expended their time and resources on this march. And as a matter of fact, we are now circulating a statement which we'll be sending to the marchers in Cairo and in Gaza. And we will say that the undersigned stress our fervent belief that the Gaza Freedom March is a historic undertaking, that this effort involving tens of thousands of people heightened international consciousness about the siege on Gaza and the question of Palestine in general, and exposed the efforts of the United States, Israel, and the Egyptian government to promote the division and control of the Middle East for their own selfish reasons.
What did the Egyptian foreign minister say when they forbade the Gaza Freedom Marchers from getting into Gaza?
Well, the first thing they said is that we've made this decision and it's because of the tense situation along the border, and that you will not be able to meet in Cairo. Any permits to meet in Cairo have been canceled. You will not be able to display any banners, and you cannot travel outside of Cairo except for tourism reasons. But he made another statement when they said that they would allow 100 people to go in, where he said that we have let the good people go travel into Gaza, the ones who sincerely support the Palestinians like we in Egypt do, and we have separated them from the hoodlums and the hooligans that are part of the marchers who have come here to hurt Egypt. Well, this is, absolutely outrageous statement on his part, a statement that we totally reject. We think that Egypt has played a very deleterious role here, and we totally reject any kind of interference with our ability to enter into Gaza and stand in solidarity with the Palestinians.
We're talking about a march of about 1,400 people from 43 countries and also an aid convoy of, I think, 250 trucks with humanitarian aid.
Yes.
This effort to break the siege has two different prongs. There's the Gaza Freedom March that Abdin has talked about. Then there's Viva Palestina, which is a convoy of trucks loaded with humanitarian aid that actually did go in several months ago. They were going in again. They're being led by George Galloway, who is a former member of parliament in England. And they are stuck in Jordan. And one of the conditions that the Egyptians gave them was that they would have to get permission from Israel to go in the other direction to get through, which was the first real proof that we had that there was collusion going on. And they are stuck in Jordan. And the Egyptians have, the most recent thing I know about, unless Abdin knows more, is that the Egyptians said the trucks can go through eventually, meaning who knows when, but the people can't. They are thinking about going through Syria to get to Cairo and then go through Cairo to the border. This is a massive international effort to prevent the Palestinians from getting the help that they need. And it required a massive international counterattack, as Abdin said. And we're incredibly admiring of the people in Gaza who, once they got there, were faced with the most unbelievable organizational problems. The Egyptians had given them a permit to meet in a church. There are over 1,300 of them, 1,362. They canceled the permit. They canceled the buses. They were picking up cab drivers who might take people to Al Arish. How would they communicate with each other? And the Egyptians said, if you're in a group larger than six, we'll pick you up. And if you saw on Democracy Now!, they even went to the bridge over the Nile and were leaving messages, written messages, for the people in Gaza. And the Egyptian security police were coming in and ripping down these messages. So they've had horrendous difficulties communicating with each other and somehow or other have managed to keep things going. Could I also say that the French did something entirely by themselves, and they have been lying down in the street for 3 days already in front of the French embassy. The ambassador apparently and his wife have been coming out and talking to them. Apparently he's kind of sympathetic. They're surrounded by a huge cordon of Egyptian police, riot police, and they've been out there for 3 days. Now, whenever this is broadcast, we don't know exactly how this is going to resolve.
You know, the Gaza Freedom March had been working with the Egyptian authorities for months, supplying them with information and telling them about the preparation for the march. It was only very abruptly that the organizers were informed, after many had already gone to Cairo, that the Egyptians were not going to allow the people to enter Gaza. As a result of that, the organizers in Gaza had to meet to try to develop a strategy to help change the Egyptian decision, denying people entry into Gaza. So they tried hanging the names of the victims of the attack on Gaza a year ago on the bridge. They held meetings at the journalist syndicate. They sent people to various embassies mm-hmm. to talk to them. They sent them to the Arab League. They had an open letter to Mubarak that they published. Mm-hmm. They said, we did not come here to Egypt to demonstrate or to create any difficulty for the government. We came here to go to Gaza to stand in solidarity with the Palestinians in Gaza. But the Egyptian government, for their own reasons, interestingly enough, they held a demonstration against Netanyahu and Mubarak meeting when he was there. But they did get an audience with the wife of the president of Egypt, Suzanne Mubarak. And a number of people went there, and they met with her and pleaded with her to get a reversal of the decision not to allow the marchers in. Well, they abruptly got a communication saying, well, 100 marchers could go in, but you've got to give us the names in 2 hours.
2 hours.
2 hours. So this created a problem. This was a divide and rule decision by the Egyptians. They wanted to create more confusion, more conflict among the marchers, etc. And so two buses did pull out from Cairo, leaving to Gaza with some people. And there was a lot of principal debate about whether or not they should accept this question of 100 people going into Gaza or not. And it was a legitimate discussion. But the problem was is that they did not have the facility to make a really timely, informed decision on that. But 100 people did leave, including Amira Haas, the journalist from Haaretz newspaper, Bernadine Dorn.
Ali Abu Nima this morning said on Democracy Now! That a lot of people on these buses are Palestinians who now have a chance to meet their families that they have been separated from in Gaza. So we're not exactly sure who is on the bus and who isn't on the bus, but he said several Palestinians.
And they're also taking in some humanitarian supplies, much of mm-hmm. the humanitarian supplies that people had. And the hunger strikers, I believe, are the ones also going. Hedy Epstein, the 85-year-old hunger striker, I believe that she was one of the people that was selected.
Well, there's some question. Ali Abu Nima said maybe not. But they may not be able to communicate with each other there. So I think that's why things
are
up in the air.
Our own Michael Ratner, who's over there, sent us a note. I'm not sure how we got it. But he said that permitting 100 to go rather than 1,000 belies the government's stance that this is based on security.
What are the reasons why the Egyptians would not allow this? And secondly, what's the United States position with respect to this as well?
Well, the Egyptians get $1.7 billion a year from the United States since Camp David in order to keep Israel in the Western strategic camp in the Middle East after the conclusion of the peace treaty between Egypt and Israel. It could not be that Israel would get $3 billion a year and Egypt get nothing. So the United States Congress voted to give, make Egypt the second largest aid recipient in the world, and it gets $1.7 billion a year from the United States. And several years ago, in Congress, they tried to pass a law to take $100 million away from Egypt because they said they were smuggling through these tunnels into Gaza. So Egypt got the message, unless you play ball with us and do what we tell you, you're going to get your aid cut. So that is the reason why Egypt is doing this.
How would you characterize the government of Egypt? As a democracy or something else?
Well, no question, it's not a democracy. Mubarak has been in power since 1981. He has not had any free elections in Egypt. It's essentially a police state. They have more people in their police and intelligence services than they have in the army. It's a huge amount of money is expended on this intelligence infrastructure in the country.
And Dorothy, let me ask you this. What do you think the role of the United States is in preventing the Gaza Freedom March from entering Gaza?
Well, Bernadine Dorn sent out an email about how they tried to get into the American embassy in Cairo with great difficulty. Some got in. Some people were detained by the Egyptians. They got absolutely nowhere. So it's perfectly obvious that the United States is, if not encouraging, at least sitting back and doing nothing. Because one phone call, that's all it takes, is one phone call.
I remember after Obama was elected, but not yet in office, when the massacre was going on in Gaza, he said nothing. Nothing was said by this country. And I just learned today that the Egyptians are building a barrier underneath the ground so that tunnels can't get from Egypt into Gaza, and that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is facilitating that construction.
Yes,
that is going to go down. These are metal barriers that are going down 50 feet. It's being paid for by the United States and engineered by the United States. And 60% of the economy of Gaza now is dependent upon that tunnel trade. This is an area that has been driven into extreme poverty. This siege has been a siege of suffocation. And these tunnels were just a little kind of breathing room, if you will, for the Gazans. If you recall, a year and a half ago, the Gazans exploded the wall and poured half of the population of Gaza poured over the border between Gaza and Egypt and into Rafah to buy goods and take livestock back, etc. And the Egyptians have since put those walls back up, and now they're going to prevent these tunnels. And so essentially, the Gaza is this huge open-air concentration camp. That's what it really is. And this is something that Egypt and Israel and the United States are all complicit in allowing.
Dorothy, is that because they made the mistake of democratically voting in a Hamas government?
Well, it's largely for that. But I actually was in Gaza before Hamas was elected, and it was very difficult to get in even then. And they have had a lid on Gaza for years and years. People from Gaza unable to get out. Let us not forget, we can't get in, but they can't get out. And they can go absolutely nowhere, nowhere. So they're trapped. This is the largest civilian population in the world that is completely trapped.
And I think one of the most densely populated.
And one of the most densely
What are the dimensions of Gaza and how many people are in there?
There are 1.5 million people.
And now the whole infrastructure has been destroyed by the Israeli Air Force, which was supplied by the United States.
Yes.
So, for example, the sewage treatment plant or the water filtration plant are no longer working.
Yes.
I understand that children are getting kidney disease because they're drinking salt water.
Yes. The only other thing is, if you ever go, if you've been to Gaza, this could be the Riviera of the Mediterranean. I mean, they are sitting on prime real estate, which is why when the settlers were there, there were 8,000 settlers, 1.5 million Palestinians, and the settlers had 30% of the beachfront territory. They had 30% of the beachfront territory. This could be an unbelievable place if anybody would just let them live like human beings.
But there's a holding pen for people who were driven out of Palestine several times, not just refugees from 48, but from other wars after that.
That's right.
Michael, as recently as September of 2009, a UN fact-finding mission found that the blockade amounted to collective punishment, which was a war crime and a crime against humanity, and that the matter should be referred to the International Criminal Court. But that's not going to happen because the United States won't let it happen. And the United States is doing what it has done now for 60 years, and that is run interference for Israel. And until that stops, nothing's going to change, because right now Israel is under siege politically in the world as much as the Palestinians are under siege from a humanitarian standpoint. They've lost support, enormous support in the world, and without the support and the Goldstone Report and the way that they've undermined the Goldstone Report with the support of the United States is a good example of that. This country has a great deal to answer for when it comes to the crimes that are being committed.
Absolutely.
Draw a balance sheet. Although the Egyptian government, with covert support of Israel and the United States, would not allow the Gaza Freedom Marchers in, nonetheless, it seems to me that this was a big victory. What's your take on it?
Well, it's an enormous victory because tens of thousands of people are being energized by this. They have seen what is going on. They've understand the connections. They've really put a lot of effort into this, and they're coming back, and they'll come back to their respective countries and tell them what went on, what they saw, what they heard, who they talked to. Not only that, but I received an email from the legal coordinator for the march, and they've been meeting with a few Egyptian human rights lawyers there. And the Egyptians are thrilled by what these marchers have been doing in Cairo. And some of this has reached out into the media and other parts of the Arab world. This can have a very salutary effect. It can help build the kind of international movement that we need to get change on this subject. That's why it's important.
Dorothy, you've been active, really a central figure in Jews Say No here in New York City. Do you detect any movement amongst the Jewish community, which is so large here, subsequent to the massacre in Gaza and the Goldstone Report, which called it a war crime? Are liberals in the Jewish community splitting away from their heretofore solid support for the government of Israel? What's your take?
Well, my take is, it's very hard when you're in the middle of it to make an evaluation. But if you have the long view, since the Second Intifada, organizations in the Jewish community have sprouted up all over the United States. There are dozens now, dozens and dozens of people who are just totally fed up. They are not going to be blindly loyal to Israel anymore. We stand out on the street, and a lot of people come by and curse us and call us names. But many people have come by and said, this always makes me cry, because they say, you're so brave to be out here. And I think, brave. If I was in Gaza, that would be brave. But I'm standing on 79th Street and Broadway, and I'm so brave. And people say, thank you. Thank you for doing this. Well, people who have been around for 25 years say nobody ever said thank you. There's something happening. That's why people who are crazy maniacs like Dershowitz, is going completely wild. This is definitely a difference in the past 10 years. Absolutely a difference. We're out there. We're still out there.
But can I just say one word about that? The problem is not where the public is in this country. The problem is with the politicians. And the problem with the politicians is because of the campaign financing system
that we
have and the money that keeps them in office. This is where the problem is. It's not just on Palestine. It's on a whole bunch of other issues, healthcare. All these other issues. And that's where the real problem is. And until there's change in the campaign financing system in this country, we're going to just see a continuation of the same thing that we're seeing today.
I think that the tipping point with respect to South Africa came when the South African government lost all of its moral credibility. Disintegration was very rapidly after that. And I think your point about Dershowitz going crazy is really very true, because I think he sees that this could happen to Israel.
Yes. And we haven't even mentioned BDS, you know, boycott, divestment, and sanctions.
It.
You know, there are ongoing events all the time where after this guy Levayev, the diamond merchant, people go down and sing, you know, newly written Christmas and Hanukkah songs in front of his place. There's BDS stuff going on all over the place. And the pressure is definitely on. I think what Abdin says about our own country, I mean, we have the burden, you see. If you're Jewish, you have two burdens. You're Jewish and you're American. But we're all members of the United States political entity. And what we do, we have to do this. The burden is on us. We've got to do what Abdin says. We've got to keep mobilizing people here, because when it changes here, it will change everywhere.
Gaza Freedom March, do you have a website that we could tell our audience about?
GazaFreedomMarch.org, and it has enormous amount of information. It has constant updates about what's happening, and I encourage people to go to it.
Well, how many New Yorkers did you raise funds for and send over there? And I imagine that they're going to be coming back and, mm-hmm. and talking about their experience. What was the size of the delegation from here?
There were 80.
No kidding.
From New York State.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't exactly know how it broke it down with the city, but there were 80 from New York. 300 plus from the United States. The French were somewhere around 250 plus. The French in the United States were the biggest. And I must say, the French have, they're really out there. My hat's off to them. If I could say it in French, I would say it in French. It's possible that if the pressure is kept up, which I hope it will be, maybe they, I don't know what the Egyptians will decide to do. I don't know what's going to happen in Gaza with the Gaza March itself, which is supposed to be 50,000 Palestinians. If there's any press in there, if the New York Times decides to tell its correspondent, Ethan Bronner, that he should do something or say something, they have a stringer in there in Gaza. So we don't exactly know what's going to happen. But I agree that so far this was a stupendous effort. And the emails that you get are so incredibly touching, especially from young people who say they were there, and the person on their left was from Japan. The person on their right was from Denmark. This person was from Brazil. This is an international effort that they've never participated in, and it's really a tremendous shot in the arm, I think.
There were 20 people from South Africa that went, two of whom were
right.
judges.
Really?
We've
That's
had
right.
a dozen of the people that went from the New York area were university students.
That's right.
So it's an incredible mix of people of all different ages, races, and so forth. And it's just an absolutely beautiful thing to see what has been accomplished with modern technology, the internet and mm-hmm. texting and this new electronic ability to mobilize people internationally. It's just remarkable. And that is what has changed, I think, the possibility of political action that can be effective. It's just wonderful.
If you'll allow me a personal question, and this question is addressed to both of you. Abdin, you're from an Arab background, Dorothy, Jewish background. What was it that brought you, Dorothy, you can answer first and Abdin second. What was it that brought you personally to the position where you two are leaders in this movement to support and express solidarity with the Palestinians?
In my case, there was a strong tradition in Jewish life that you cannot stand idly by. You cannot. And many of us absorb that. And we went to Spain and fought against Franco. We went to the civil rights movement. In my case, how could I possibly go south and fight for equal rights and stand by while this was going on? So I went there. And anybody who goes there, I defy them not to be changed. That's what happened to me. So it was 2002, and then I said, everything is different now. This is what I have to do.
Abdin?
Well, my story is a little complicated, but I'll try to make it as succinct as possible. I was 8 years old when Israel was created, and I lived in a very small town in northern Michigan where I was born, where my father, who had immigrated to this country in 1909, settled, he and my mother. And I didn't know any Arabic. They spoke Arabic between themselves, but I really didn't know any. But I remember very well that in 1948, my father used to lean down at a Stromberg Carlson shortwave radio and press his ear to the speaker to listen to a shortwave radio broadcast. And I didn't know what he was listening to, but he had this very serious look on his face, and he would do this on different nights. And he never spoke to me about it or anything. Well, a year or so after that, he and I were in an automobile accident together, and he was killed in that accident. And then later on, I began to try to understand my father and what he represented and so forth. He had immigrated to this country from Lebanon. And I understood much later on that what he was listening to were the reports that were coming out of the Middle East about what was happening in Palestine. And that was what was troubling him. Well, I went on to college and I studied Arabic. I had to take a foreign language, so I said, I'll study Arabic. And I wasn't learning it to speak it in the university, so I said, I'll take some time off and go to the Middle East and I'll try to study it there. So I went to Cairo and I spent 6 months. And then I came back and I went to law school and I got involved in the civil rights movement and started, got involved in the Lawyers Guild, et cetera, et cetera. And then after I finished law school, I didn't want to go off and fight in the Vietnam War, so I went again to the Middle East and spent another year there and studied. And when I came back, just after I came back from the Middle East on that second trip, the 67 war happened. And it was like somebody had taken a ton of bricks and dropped it right on top of me, because so much of the stuff that I heard and listened to and read about was stuff that I could relate to because I knew it. So that's how I got involved.
Dorothy Avdin, thank you very much for your good work in the solidarity movement with the Palestinians. And thank you for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Today we're joined by ex-political prisoner and human rights organizer Victor Toro. Victor is a Bronx community organizer and a former leader in the resistance to Chile's military dictatorship during the 70s. In July 2007, he was arrested in an immigration sweep by border officials on an Amtrak train in Rochester, New York. He was charged for being in the country illegally and has been out on bail ever since. Before coming to the United States in 1984, Toro helped found and lead the MIR, or Revolution Left Movement. The group opposed the U.S.-sponsored coup against the military dictatorship, led by Augusto Pinochet. As many listeners know, during the Pinochet reign, thousands who opposed the regime were killed, disappeared, and many more tortured. The Department of Homeland Security and U.S. Immigration are now seeking to deport Toro. The prosecution has filed a 46-page brief containing information on the MIR, claiming that the group attacked government buildings. Meanwhile, a deportation hearing for Toro has been adjourned until January 11, 2010. Victor joins us today in the studio with his translator, Gonzalo Venegas.
We're very honored to have Victor Toro here on Law and Disorder. Victor was twice a victim of 9/11. What I mean by that is that the other 9/11 was the United States-sponsored coup in Chile on September 11th of 1973, when the democratically elected socialist government was overthrown. People were rounded up, killed, disappeared, tortured. Many fled. Victor Toro was one such person. He was in the MIR, which is the revolutionary movement of the left in Chile, fled the Pinochet dictatorship, came to the United States, lived here for all these years, was picked up in an immigration raid in Rochester. He's asking for political asylum. The court hearing is on January 11th. We're going to speak with Victor today about his situation. Victor Toro, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Gracias.
Victor, you came to the United States in 1984. Can you briefly describe the circumstances of why you came here?
Bueno, llegué aquí a Estados Unidos, pues, arrancando de la dictadura militar de Pinochet.
In 1984, fleeing the dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet in Chile, I was arrested by Pinochet's regime on April 20th of 1974. I was incarcerated for 3 years under the Pinochet regime in different concentration camps in which I underwent torture at the hands of the Pinochet dictatorship.
You came to New York City directly?
No, yo fui expulsado por la dictadura con un papel que decía que solo era...
I was expelled by the dictatorship of Pinochet. I was given a document that said that was valid only for leaving and never returning to Chile. I was first expelled to Sweden, in which I was initially granted political asylum. After that, I ended up in Cuba.
Hasta finalmente establecerme en México, donde se me dio un asilo transitorio. Pero en México mi vida corría peligro porque los esbirros de Pinochet me andaban buscando para asesinar.
I ended up in Mexico where I was given a transitional asylum. However, my safety was at risk in Mexico because of agents of Pinochet's government in Mexico trying to murder me.
When did you come to the United States?
Bueno, 1984, por ese peligro que corría en México, por atravesar la frontera como indocumentado.
I fled Mexico in 1984 and crossed the border through Ciudad de Juárez. I was fleeing Mexico, fleeing this persecution by Pinochet's agents, which are well documented as the Operation Condor, which was Pinochet's regime's repression against foreign nationals, which included the case of Orlando Letelier, the ambassador of Chile in Washington, who was murdered by Pinochet's regime in Washington, D.C., the case of Carlos Prats in Argentina, and I was fleeing for that reason.
So you ended up in the Bronx and have been a community organizer since?
Bueno, yo he hecho en los Estados Unidos lo que hice durante toda mi vida en Chile. Yo era un dirigente sindical, un dirigente social comunitario que tenía conocimiento sobre las culturas.
Well, in the South Bronx, I continued doing the work, an extension of the work that I had done in Chile in my earlier years, which is working in the community, working with unions, working with the community in terms of our indigenous cultures, our indigenous arts. And that work I continued doing for 25 years here in the South Bronx with an organization that we formed called Movimiento La Peña del Bronx.
Victor, it's true, isn't it, that you were picked up by the government on an immigration raid?
Bueno, entre una de las tareas a las que yo me he dedicado aquí en Estados Unidos es a defender los derechos de los inmigrantes por ser un inmigrante y por ser un indocumentado.
One of the work that I have done here in the United States is always advocating for immigrant rights and the rights of undocumented people here in the United States.
Yo soy participo de las coaliciones primero de mayo en todos los Estados Unidos.
I participate in many of the May 1st mobilizations throughout the United States that advocate for workers and immigrants' rights.
En 1987 me encontraba en California apoyando la lucha de los inmigrantes.
In California in 2007, I was engaging in some of the work with the advocacy work for immigrant rights. Upon my return to New York on an Amtrak train, I was caught up in an immigration raid in which immigration and customs enforcement agents officials entered the train with bomb-sniffing dogs and racially profiled folks who were on the train, and I was caught up in that raid.
And now they want to deport you, and you're asking for political asylum. Your hearing is coming up on January 11th here in New York City. I understand they're accusing you of terrorism. And my question, Victor, is this. As a lifelong socialist activist, how do you refute that accusation of terrorism?
Este proceso lleva ya más de dos años. En un primer momento, tanto las autoridades como nuestros abogados lucharon para defenderme como un simple ilegal, como un simple indocumentado.
This case has already gone on for 2 years now, with my last case approaching now on January 11th. And for initially, I was facing the same case as any other undocumented worker here in the United States.
Pero en este año recién, el gobierno ha emitido dos documentos donde se me hacen grandes acusaciones y se me quiere entonces ahora juzgar no como ilegal, no como indocumentado, sino como por mi pasado político, por mi pasado social y mi pasado sindical y entre ellos mi condición de haber sido miembro del MIR de Chile.
Recently, however, the prosecution against me has taken a political turn in which the government has presented documents against me that have changed the tone of the case from merely me being an undocumented immigrant to them accusing me of being a terrorist and accusing me because of the affiliations and the work that I did in Chile during the 1970s.
Well, what exactly did you do in Chile?
¿Qué exactamente hizo en Chile? ¿Qué causa eso?
Bueno, el MIR fue una organización que se propuso hacer una revolución social, construir el poder popular y que los trabajadores tomaran el gobierno, el poder.
Well, I was a leader of the organization, the MID, the Movement of the Revolutionary Left, in that time proposed a social revolution, proposed building a government of popular power, of building the power of the poor and the workers in Chile.
Y el MIR combatió a Pinochet con la fuerza de la armas para derrotarlo y para las autoridades de Estados Unidos esa práctica política del MIR era terrorista y como yo fui miembro de esa organización supuestamente pues yo era un terrorista.
And since MID resisted my organization MID resisted the Pinochet regime's repressive tactics, MID was branded as a terrorist organization by the United States government, and me being a member and a leader of the MID organization, it followed that they are now accusing me of being a terrorist.
I understand that the government is presenting documents, CIA-related documents, Freedom of Information Act documents, as evidence in this case. Can you describe briefly what's in those?
Los documentos presentados son todos documentos archi conocidos, pero están desclasificados desde el año 98 en los Estados Unidos.
The documents that the government is presenting are declassified CIA documents that have been publicly declassified since 1998.
El documento específico que presente el abogado de migración.
The specific document that the immigration officials are presenting.
Es valiéndose de los informes de la DINA de Pinochet.
Are based on information provided by Pinochet's secret police.
De un agente de la CIA en Santiago de Chile.
Of a CIA agent stationed in Chile during that time.
O sea, es el informe de dos organizaciones terroristas de que son acusadas y investigadas universalmente como organizaciones que han matado mucha gente en el mundo.
these two organizations, the CIA and the DINA, the Chilean secret police under the Pinochet regime, are the real terrorist organizations that has been proven and declassified and shown that they have been responsible for murders throughout the world.
Para mí es una paradoja que dos organizaciones terroristas me quieran acusar de terrorista cuando yo he sido toda una vida un dirigente social sindical de uniones.
For me, is a very ironic to have two organizations that I consider terrorist organizations like the DINA, the Chilean secret police, and the CIA to be accusing me of being a terrorist.
Yes, I say doubly ironic because I remember it was Henry Kissinger who said that no people have a right to elect a socialist government. And it was Kissinger who was then Secretary of State, and the CIA and the big American corporations, including ITT, that sponsored this illegal and violent overthrow of a democratically elected government. And now they're turning around and saying that Victor Toros, who's never done anything illegal, is a terrorist. It really is ironic. Victor Toros, it's really an honor to have you on Law and Disorder. I want to remind our listeners that they can participate in a support rally for you. It's Friday night on the 8th of January at Martin Luther King Auditorium.
Friday, January 8th from 6 to 11 p.m., we're going to be having a celebration. We're going to be using culture as resistance to inform people about Victor's case and also to get donations for his defense. It is on Friday, January 8th at the SEIU 1199 Martin Luther King Auditorium. That's at 310 West 43rd Street between 8th and 9th in New York City. We're going to have multiple artists. We're going to be having the Rebel Diaz will be there, folk music. And again, it's going to be we're really raising funds for his defense and also want people to know about his case. And we will be using that night culture as a form of resistance.
And importantly, the court date is on Monday, January 11th. We're posting a link on our website about where it is. We'll know what courtroom specifically, but there will be a rally after the 9 a.m. hearing that people are invited to attend.
Correct, correct. On the day of Victor's last court date, in which his fate will be decided at the hands of the immigration courts, is Monday, January 11th. His trial will be starting at 9 a.m. We are at noon having a rally at 26 Federal Plaza in support of Victor. Regardless of the outcome, we want to show our unity as a people there. We're calling for his political asylum.
I think the important question is, what happens if Victor is deported?
Ese es un riesgo, pero se da otro caso que en los tiempos de la dictadura de Pinochet, yo fui muerto, asesinado en Chile. Así que este será un estoy legalmente asesinado, incluso con papel de disfunción del sistema legal chileno, y por tanto yo ni en Chile ni aquí podría vivir. Es un problema que tiene que resolver la ley de los Estados Unidos. Yo creo que yo debo obtener el asilo político porque mi vida está destinada a la lucha del pueblo, de la comunidad en el Bronx, y 25 años, mi mujer es ciudadana norteamericana y mi hija es una residente de este país, mi familia está aquí ahora.
There is a risk of me being deported. However, if that is the case, in which I will be being separated from both my daughter, who is a U.S. Permanent legal resident, and my wife, who is a United States citizen, both the U.S. government and the Chilean government will have a huge conundrum on their hands if they do choose to deport me. In Chile, when I was forced to leave Chile, I was officially declared dead by the Pinochet regime. So in Chile, I don't exist. I am officially I'm officially dead in Chile. So if they do decide to deport me, the legal conundrum and the ramifications of the U.S. involvement in Chile during that time will be a conundrum that the U.S. and Chilean legal system will have to deal with if they do choose to deport me and separate me from my family and separate me from the work that I do here in the South Bronx, which is a work of social activism, a work of uniting and working with the poor and the workers.
Yeah, and I would also add, as you informed us, that although there's a so-called, in quote, socialist head of state in Chile, many of the top officials there were officials under the Pinochet regime, and it's quite dangerous for Victor to go back there.
Okay. En mi blog hay amplia información sobre Chile, el rebeldía de los inmigrantes.
You can all go to my website, which is La Rebeldía de los Inmigrantes. Blogspot.com, which has ample information regarding this supposed democracy that exists in Chile.
El abogado de inmigración en el segundo documento dedica 40 páginas a explicar las bonanzas del milagro chileno que nos dejó Pinochet.
In the evidence being presented against me, aside from the CIA documents, is 40 plus pages of information regarding Chile's miracle, the miracle that the miracle economy and the miracle democracy that was created as a result of the Pinochet dictatorship that the government is using as evidence against me to show that Chile has supposedly transitioned to democracy.
Y no es casual que Estados Unidos defienda a Chile, porque en Chile hay una fuerza armada pinochetista, un congreso y un parlamento pinochetista, un tribunal de justicia pinochetista y un estado económico y una constitución política pinochetista. Es decir, en Chile lo que ha cambiado es el gobierno, pero no el estado que dejó Pinochet.
And it's not a coincidence that the United States defend and claim that Chile is a democracy now, when in reality, if you look at the president of the Senate, the president of the House of Representatives there, the armed forces, the Navy, it is all led by folks from Pinochet's political party, folks who participated in the dictatorship. The Chilean government, the Chilean political economic model is one that was created under the Pinochet dictatorship and still exists to this day. So we may have a different label on the government, but the model that exists, the social economic structure and the political structure that exists is still that of Pinochet.
Well, thank you very much, Victor Toro, and thank you, Gonzalo, for your wonderful job of translating. We encourage everybody to come out both Friday night and Monday. We're going to put up the leaflet on our website, lawanddisorder.org. We're going to link to your website, Victor. Gonzalo, will you please give us that website?
Yes. The website, I'll spell it out for you. It's La Rebeldía de los Inmigrantes. That's LAREBELDIA. DELOSINMIGRANTES.blogspot.com. La Rebeldía de los Inmigrantes.blogspot.com for more information.
We wish you all the luck in the world. Thanks so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Muchas gracias a ustedes porque con su ayuda, pues vamos a ganar, vamos a vencer.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.